It's October 1998, and a young, fit individual in a laboratory at St. Olav's Hospital in Trondheim is running hard on a treadmill. For part of the workout, the incline is set at 25 degrees, the equivalent of running up a steep ski slope. Week after week, this individual and her 17 other companions have been training 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, in the service of research. After only 2 weeks of training, the study participants are so eager to begin their sessions that they literally leap onto the treadmills when the time comes. But here's the thing. Those treadmills, they're only 40 centimeters long. And the pay for each session? One tiny piece of a Crispo chocolate bar. Because these exercise fanatics, they're rats. Yes, rats. And their job is to help a young PhD student named Ulrich Wiesloff answer an important question. Can high-intensity exercise help people who have heart disease live longer, healthier lives?
And I was working with Olympic athletes in cross-country skiing and how they trained and gave advice to them. And we found really smart ways to do exercise training, endurance training. And when I started here at the Faculty of Medicine in 1997, I thought, why shouldn't we use the same principles in cardiac patients as we do in athletes?
The specific kind of training that Ulrich is talking about is called high-intensity interval training, or HIIT. High-intensity means you train at least 85% of your maximum heart rate. And the interval part means you only have to train for a relatively short period, commonly just a series of 4-minute intervals. Ulrich had already seen just how powerful high-intensity training had been in training elite skiers. It really strengthened their heart muscles. Researchers could actually measure this change with a cardiopulmonary exercise called VO2 max. Why couldn't the same technique help heart patients too? At the time, cardiologists knew that it was good for heart attack patients to exercise to improve their quality of life, and possibly to reduce the risk of additional heart attacks. But the conventional wisdom in 1997 or 1998 was to prescribe moderate exercise, not high-intensity training. So, is your doctor going to recommend that you go out and peg your heart rate nearly up to its max, even if it's just for a few minutes at a time? As Ulrich found out, the answer was definitely not.
What happened when I started at the Faculty of Medicine was that I asked the cardiologist, couldn't we use the same principles as we do in athletes in heart failure patients? And they said, yes, let's do that, but you're crazy, you can't do it in humans, you have to start in rats. And I had never seen a rat before, at least not a laboratory rat. So that was the start, and we built treadmills for rats.
Yes, the little tiny treadmills, with the ability to measure the rat's oxygen uptake.
Long story short, we found really nice results. I presented at the American College of Sports Medicine, and the auditorium was full, and it was a lot of wows. And then I said in the end, because I sort of got high on myself, I said that, okay, now we have got approval to do this in humans. And then one famous cardiologist were in the back of the auditorium. He said, you have a great study, Ulrich, but you can't do this in humans. You will kill them.
I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and this is 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. We all know that exercise is good for us, but just how good? What kind of exercise? And for whom? Today, I'm going to tell you a story of how exercise, actually, high-intensity interval training, went from being a way for elite athletes to get faster and stronger to doing everything from improving the lives and longevity of heart patients to helping seniors age better. And maybe, just maybe, it could also help Alzheimer's patients, but not in the way you might think. It's a story about a huge Norwegian health-related database called Hunt, a website that attracted millions of users who willingly entered information for researchers about how they train, and 1,500 people age 70 and older signing up to be human guinea pigs. And, of course, there are the rats training like crazy on their treadmills. And behind all of this is the big mystery, which is only just beginning to be solved. Can exercise really be the magic pill that medical researchers have hunted for decades? Many researchers across the globe have looked at exercise and high-intensity interval training in specific. In Norway, however, the undisputed leader in this field is NTNU's Ulrik Wiesloff, now a professor and head of the Cardiac Exercise Research Group here at the university. After Ulrik went to the American College of Sports Medicine conference, he did exactly what the famous cardiologist told him not to do. He recruited 27 patients with heart failure with an average age of 75. One-third of them did moderate training, one-third did high-intensity training, and the last third served as the control group and was just given the standard advice regarding physical activity. It wasn't easy, though. No one had actually studied the effects of high-intensity training in human heart patients. But Ulrik, as you have heard, had already studied this in rats. That was the study he presented to the American College of Sports Medicine. And not only had he studied high-intensity interval training in healthy rats, he had also looked at the physiological changes that happened in rats that train this way after having had massive heart attacks. In all cases, high-intensity training radically improved their cardiac functioning. Nevertheless, you might reasonably wonder if he was a little nervous about getting 75-year-old heart patients to train intensively.
Yeah, I was not, because I knew that the intensity is relative. So a heart failure patient that works at, let's say, 90% of their peak capacity, they're walking at 2.5 kilometers per hour, whereas an endurance athlete runs at 30 kilometers an hour.
Even so?
It was hard to convince the cardiologist that this was safe. And it was also hard to convince the patients in the beginning that, because that intensity we want them to train on was so that they breathe heavily and they get really sweat. And the first 2-3 sessions, they were quite nervous, but after 2-3 sessions, they did it themselves and we just showed up and saw that everything was okay. But it was a huge change in the cardiology area, because just a few years before I started, the advice was that these patients should be at rest. They shouldn't have any exertion that raised their breath or, yeah.
That particular paper has been cited nearly 3,000 times since it was first published in 2007. Ulrik is quick to point out that many other people have, and still do, work with interval training.
We didn't invent interval training. They have done that in Germany for many years, at least in athletes. But what our contribution has been is that what can we expect on the cellular and organ level when you do different types of exercise?
Ulrik and his colleagues began to publish a series of papers describing the benefits of high-intensity training in people with heart disease. They also began looking at the benefits of high-intensity training on something called metabolic syndrome, which is a combination of high blood pressure, obesity, and high blood sugar levels, all of which put people at high risk of cardiovascular disease. They looked at how the heart muscle improved in people who already have cardiovascular disease when they exercised at high intensity. They looked at dementia.
In athletes, they do a lot of high-intensity training, but they also do a lot of moderate intensity. So we thought it was a good idea to compare those different types of populations with metabolic diseases, cardiac diseases, dementia, and so on.
And they found some dramatic differences. As just one of many examples, when they studied the effects of high-intensity training compared to moderate exercise in patients with metabolic syndrome, they found high-intensity training significantly reduced the number of risk factors that cause metabolic syndrome compared to moderate exercise. Basically, in all cases, the benefits came from really working up a sweat.
What we find is that, sadly, is that you need to raise your heart rate, which is sadly because it's much harder.
Yeah.
It would have been much easier if you just could have walk the dog and do the gardening.
But Ulrich and his colleagues still wanted to know why high-intensity training was so important. Here's where fate stepped in. Wiesloff and his colleagues were invited to participate in this giant Norwegian health study called HUNT. Briefly, the Trøndelag Health Study, or HUNT. The acronym is from its original Norwegian name, if you're curious. Began in 1984 with four waves of data collection, the last of which was in 2017. In total, researchers have collected detailed data on 250,000 individuals from northern Trøndelag County. There were questionnaires about everything from health-related behaviors, illnesses, socioeconomic conditions, and much more, collected multiple times over the four decades since the study began. Plus, participants underwent a range of medical tests, and in many cases, researchers collected biological samples like blood, saliva, and DNA, all of which now are frozen in a biobank and available for research.
We were asked if we would like to do something in that study, and I said, yes, we would like to test VO2max on all people, or healthy people, and see how will this go.
VO2max is your maximum oxygen uptake, and it's a standard measure of how fit you are. Remember, that's what Ulrich used to measure the effects of his high-intensity training on elite skiers. To do this particular test, you run on a treadmill or ride a bike wearing a mask that measures the amount of oxygen you breathe in and the amount of carbon dioxide you exhale. And then you run or bike as hard as you possibly can until your VO2 measurements flatten out.
Is it so that those with high fitness live longer, healthier than those with low fitness, and so on? And so we did. So we tested 5,000 people in 2005, 2007, in HUNT 3, and we have followed these people up to now. We have blood from them. We are able to study the genetics. We have access to journals. We have access to quality registries.
One of the advantages of the HUNT studies is that Norway has socialized medicine. Your medical records are linked under something that's called a fødselsnummer, which is like a U.S. Social Security number. That number links you to all your health-related information, the medicines you're prescribed, and to different health registries, including the death registry.
So we can see, did this man or woman, did he or she get a heart attack or dementia, the diabetes, everything? So I think that's also a goldmine that we have contributed to.
And the HUNT studies led to something that became a worldwide sensation. The World Fitness Level Calculator, where you enter a few bits of information about yourself to find out how fit you are compared to the population at large.
So we used the data from the 5,000 that we actually tested and matched those with questionnaires about the exercise habits and adjusted for marriage, not marriage, alcohol, no alcohol, and so on. And we developed a calculator that can be used anywhere in the world as long as you have internet access. That was the only requirement. So we did, and then we thought, okay, that's cool. And then I realized, of course, we have the same questions from HUNT in HUNT 3 and HUNT 1.
HUNT 1 started in 1984. HUNT 3 started in 2006. So 22 years apart.
And I thought, let's go back to the 80s. And then we plotted the data for 30,000 men, 30,000 women. And we linked their fitness number to death registries. And we saw that those with the highest fitness level, they lived longer than those with the low fitness level. And based upon that, we developed the fitness calculator that has been used by millions of people worldwide. And because we thought that to do a real test of VO2 max or maximal oxygen uptake, it requires trained people and very expensive equipment. So we thought, or I had this idea that it should be possible to predict this in a good way. Not, of course, accurate enough for athletes, but for 99% of the world's population.
Here, Ulrich had a little help from the New York Times, where reporter Gretchen Reynolds, who had begun writing about Ulrich's work, described the existence of the fitness calculator, along with the publication of a paper that showed it worked in identifying people who might be at increased risk of premature cardiovascular disease.
So that was super important. And Gretchen told me that when she wrote about that, it was almost crashed the server for New York Times. And she also realized that this is a topic that is of interest for many, many million people.
Right around this time, one of Ulrich's colleagues began looking at another related question.
My name is Dorte Stensvold, and I work as a professor in exercise physiology at NTNU in a research group called CERG, stands for the Cardiac Exercise Research Group. So in 2011, Ulrich and I discussed the possibility to perform one of the largest studies ever performed in exercise, looking at a randomized controlled trial looking at the effect of exercise on morbidity and mortality.
A randomized controlled trial is the gold standard for medical research.
Until then, every study that had been performed looking at the effect of exercise on morbidity and mortality was from observational studies, which give us a clear clue that there is a relation between health and longevity and morbidity. But the thing about observational studies is that they tell us about the association, but not about the cause and effect. And in 2012, we initiated Generation 100, which is the first study that have evaluated the effect of long-term exercise on harder endpoints such as morbidity and mortality. We invited all people born between 1936 and 1942 with a permanent address in Trondheim. So they got an invite in the mail. We ended up including 1,567 participants, approximately 50% women, which we are very, very happy about. So we actually did a randomized control trial where half of them were randomized to supervised exercise and the rest half was in a control group with no supervision. Ideally, this control group would have been sedentary, but that's impossible to get through to the ethical committee. There are so strong evidence that exercise may protect for different diseases and increased longevity. So we couldn't get that through the ethical committee. So we just said that the control group were asked to follow the recommendations for physical activity given by the health authorities. And then the other half were given supervised exercise twice a week. For the supervised exercise group, we also split them into two, where half of them were getting supervised exercise with continuous moderate intensity, and the other half was trained with high-intensity interval training.
So the youngest of the people who were invited to participate in the study were 70 at the time. Dorte said that many of them, especially the women, had been active, but mainly just by walking. High-intensity training was not something that was on their radar.
Some of them said that they've never actually had performed structured exercise. Many, many of the participants were walking a lot every day. But structured exercise, and especially with higher intensity, was very new for most of the participants, I would say. So I think they were surprised, and we are surprised, and I think the entire research society has been very surprised how well the participants have been able to perform this type of exercise, how well they have tolerated it, but also that they were actually able to perform it for 5 years.
And?
We have a lot of different findings from the Generation 100. I think we actually now have published maybe 34 papers so far. So there are a lot of findings. But in general, we found that, according to the main outcome, which was more mortality, we saw that all three groups had a much lower mortality rate than what is expected in this age group. So we have a theory that, of course, there is a selection bias.
In this kind of study, where researchers invite a huge group of people, the people who are going to say yes are the people who are already active. So it makes it more likely that these people would be in better health to begin with.
All three groups, including the control group, increased their activity levels and actually were very active during the study, which is kind of a headache for us as researchers, because it was a bit hard to compare them because the control group were so active. The expected mortality in this age group in the general population is between 10 and 12%. We saw, as I said, in general, that the mortality rate in all three groups was in after 5 years, it was 4.7, so much lower than what it's expected. So we might be related to that day we have such an active group. Further, our data demonstrate that those who exercise with high intensity had more health benefits compared to the other groups. It was a clear tendency that they had a lower mortality rate compared to the moderate group. And also, there was a significant fitness level after 5 years, or throughout the study, after 1, 3, and 5 years, the high intensity group had higher oxygen uptake, maximal oxygen uptake, which is a very clear indicator for future health. So we also found that they reported higher levels of quality of life, actually, after 5 years than the two other groups.
But how much exercise is enough? It's one thing to set up a research group and offer them structured training, like Dorte in the Generation 100 study. But how do you translate this information to the average person on the street? Ulrich, of course, has thought a lot about this. A lot.
When I started out as a researcher on sort of exercise and public health, when I read the recommendations from all health authorities worldwide, I thought, do people understand this? And what is 3 METs or 6 METs, or what is brisk walking? What is this and that?
A MET is a ratio of your working metabolic rate relative to your resting metabolic rate. Your metabolic rate is the rate of energy expended per unit of time. Yeah, not so user-friendly.
And I thought, if you ask my mother to walk at 6 METs, she would never understand that. So I thought that the recommendations were really inaccurate. And I thought, and there's an agreement, that heart rate reflects what your body undertakes. So if you go uphill, your heart rate increases. If you go on a flat surface, it doesn't increase a lot. That's nothing we came up with, but that's how it is. And I thought, is it possible, using the Hunt data, to make a meaningful metric out of heart rate that can translate into health?
Once again, those 4 decades of information from Trøndelag County come into play. He had a huge data set from Hunt, and he knew that heart rate was key, because he'd already shown that the harder and faster your heart beats while you're exercising, the better it is for your overall health. The one piece they needed was the ability to measure a person's heart rate. And then,
in 2014-ish, all the hand-wrist-worn wearables came along and all measured heart rate, but no one told you what that heart rate meant. And I thought, okay, let's try it in Hunt to see, can we find a heart rate pattern over a week that translates into good health?
Still, that wasn't quite enough.
And so we started out testing that. And in the beginning, we counted how many heartbeats do you have during a week. I thought it was that easy, but it was not. So everyone has about 700,000 beats per week, if you're an athlete or not.
In the end, it was the Hunt data that made the difference.
We managed to make an algorithm that, based purely on heart rate and gender and age, that we saw that when they had this pattern, they had good health, they had good cholesterol, they had low blood pressure, they were not obese, and so on.
And the algorithm was built into a metric called PAI. Not PAI like the food, but PAI.
PAI stands for Personal Activity Intelligence. And then we made this scale from 0 to 100, because people understand above 100 and so on. And we saw that if you had above 100, you didn't have any improved health compared to if you had 100. So 100 was sort of the optimal point. Of course, if you had 200 high points per week, you had higher respiratory fitness and so on, but you were not healthier in any other way.
There's an app under development that will allow people to use data from their sports watches to calculate their PI. It's called Mia Health and is being rolled out globally this year in 2023. It's fun because the algorithm that Ulrich and his colleagues developed can also tell you your fitness age. So the smarter you train, the younger your fitness age becomes. At the top of the podcast, I mentioned that high-intensity interval training might help Alzheimer's patients. One of Ulrich's postdocs is looking at this exact question.
My name is Atefe Rafi Tari, and I'm a postdoc at NTNU, at the Cardiac Exercise Research Group at the Institute for Medical Imaging and Circulation. So the title of my thesis is Do Physical Activity and Cardiorespiratory Fitness Hold the Key to Prevent Dementia?
And the answer?
I think so. Yes. We're still working on it. We don't have a definite answer yet, but a lot of evidence points towards that, especially these studies that we have done in Hunt.
Yep, Hunt again. 4 decades of incredibly detailed health data from more than 250,000 people.
In Trøndelag, there's also done a health and memory study where they have diagnosed a group of people with dementia who also participated in Hunt in the 80s and the 90s and were diagnosed around 2010, 2011. So with that, we thought that, okay, we can go back to the 80s and estimate their cardiorespiratory fitness or their PI level. And then also in the 90s and follow them over time and then see whether or not this is associated with later risk of developing dementia.
You probably won't be shocked at this point to hear that they found an association.
We found that there is really a strong association. We found that having a high estimated cardiorespiratory fitness or a PI level of 100, which is our go-to level, that they have about 40% reduced risk of developing dementia later. And then what was also really nice is that we saw that if they didn't have that in the 80s in Hunt 1, but they had it in Hunt 2, so that they improved their fitness or their physical activity level, then that was also associated with risk reduction just as much.
Hunt 1 started in 1984. However, if the Hunt study participants had high fitness in Hunt 1, but low fitness by Hunt 2, then it was the same as if they had never been fit.
It's like fresh meat. So you really have to maintain it, improve, and then maintain it. Otherwise, it seems like the effect will be lost.
It's one thing to find an association, but that doesn't prove there's causation. So Atefe and Ulrich and their colleagues decided to follow up on some research that had been done in mice at Stanford University in the US. There, researchers did studies where they found that old mice that got blood from young mice were rejuvenated. But what if the blood came from trained individuals? Or in this case, trained rats? Given all the causal evidence from the Hunt studies, might it make a difference? Atefe and Ulrich decided to check it out. That's right. Bring out the tiny rat treadmills.
So we have rats that are genetically manipulated to have Alzheimer's disease. So they have some Alzheimer pathology in the brain. They develop amyloid plaques in the brain. And so we use these rats to test this exercise blood hypothesis. So we had healthy young donor rats, which we trained for 10 weeks, high intensity interval training on the treadmill. And we took the blood from these healthy trained rats. And then we had sedentary rats who had just remained in their cages. And then we took our Alzheimer rats and divided them into three groups. So one of the groups got injections with the exercise blood plasma, and one group got the sedentary plasma, and we had one saline group.
Atafe and Ulrich are still writing up their results, but they did find that rats who got the exercise blood plasma showed the formation of new neurons. Now they've started on an experiment called XPLAS, for exercise plasma, where they're recruiting 60 people with Alzheimer's who will get one of three treatments. One-third will be given plasma from donors who exercise, one-third will be given saline, and one-third will be given plasma that has been collected from many different donors.
For this study, our primary outcome here is safety and tolerability and feasibility, but we do have the secondary outcome, so we will have an idea of whether it has an effect or not. And of course, we believe in it. It's our hypothesis. That's why we're doing it. But we might as well find that there is no effect. But then I still think that, okay, but there are so many confounding factors here. Is it the dosage? Is it the timing? Is it the duration of the treatment?
It will be 2 years or more before Atafe and her colleagues get their results. But there's still a lot they do know. For one thing, they know a lot about how the heart muscle changes in a good way with high-intensity training. And remember Pi, that fitness calculator? Ulrich and his team have now published a series of papers that show that people whose weekly Pi score is 100 or more,
they live longer, they get less heart attack, and so on, compared to those with lower than 100 Pi points. And we have shown that it's lower risk of getting heart attack, lower risk of developing dementia. If you develop dementia, you get it later. You live 3 years longer without dementia.
Essentially,
cardiorespiratory fitness is the key.
So, as Ulrich will tell you, and as the science clearly shows, there's no reason to wait to exercise and really break a sweat. I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you've been listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. My guests for this show were Ulrich Wiesloff, Dorte Stensfold, and Atafe Tari. For more information and links to academic articles about this research, check out our show notes. And yes, there is a link to a photo of a rat on a treadmill. Editorial help and sound design by Historia Brücke. Thanks for listening.